Welcome back to the Open Source Startup Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Robbie from Cowboy Ventures, and joined as always by Tim Chen from Essence VC. And today we are super excited to have a guest that we wanted to have on the podcast for some time. It's Amjad, who's the founder and CEO of Replit, which probably needs no introduction for most folks, but it's a collaborative browser-based development environment that we're going to hear lots more about. So welcome, Amjad. We're so excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Awesome. So we love on this podcast to go all the way back to the beginning. So we would love to hear about the earliest days of Replit and what Replit started as. Where did the idea come from?
Yeah. So, you know, I was going to school back in Amman, Jordan, where I'm from. I went to this university called Princess Sumaya University for Technology, and it was a small university dedicated to computer science and computer engineering. And around that time, I was getting obsessed with programming languages. I started reading Hacker News, reading Paul Graham's essays on Lisp. And Paul Graham had this like really fascinating essay about like how the choice of programming language actually might determine the success of a startup. And had all these technical aspects, but also social aspect around how, you know, picking a programming language could like, also you're picking the sort of the talent pool that you might hire from. But at any rate, I was obsessed with kind of programming languages. At the same time, I had all these different classes I was taking, like object-oriented programming in Java or systems programming in C. And every class had different environments set up, different versions, different languages, different packages. And I didn't have a laptop at the time. Laptops were like fairly expensive, so I couldn't afford one. I had a computer at home, had a computer at work. I was working while going to school. And I had there was computers, obviously, at the computer lab. And, you know, every time I wanted to, you know, had some time, I wanted to do a little bit of homework or just do some coding to learn the language. It was just like a huge pain in the ass to set up the development environment. I was like technical for a long time, but it still was like hard for me. For example, if you want to set up Java, you have to download Java from Sun or Oracle, whatever it was at the time. You have to download like an IDE, like NetBeans. You have to configure everything. And so that's like an hour or two. And then maybe you write a little bit of Java and then you're sort of the time's up and like you have to go somewhere else. And then, you know, you go back to the computer lab the next day and that computer, someone else is sitting on that computer. You have to do the same thing on a different computer. And I was like, okay, like, I was using Google Docs at the time. I was using Gmail. This was 2008, 2009. And I was like, okay, why can't I just write code in the browser in the same way I'm writing my docs and English and slides? And everything was moving to the browser. So I thought, surely someone has built this. So I started Googling around and there was really nothing. And it was kind of surprising. It was almost like finding $10 in Grand Central Station on the floor or something like that. I was like, what are the odds that I found this idea or I had this idea that like nobody has thought of? Obviously, people have thought of it. I was like, okay, how hard could it be? Let me try to build something. And so the first thing I built was just like a text area with some formatting and you can like type in some JavaScript. And then there's a button that says eval. So run the code. You hit eval, it alerts the answer. So you could do like 1 + 1, 2. You could write an entire program and it chose that program. And it was so primitive, yet it was like clear to me that that was the future. So I added, the first feature I added was like saving the program. And then I gave it to my friends at school and like everyone was using it. Although it supported only one language, JavaScript. That's what the browser runs. And it was so compelling for people. Even at the time I had a Symbian phone. I don't know how if you're my age, Robbie, but before the iPhone, like the smartphone that like most people used were like Nokia Symbian phones. And I remember loading up the webpage of my phone, actually being able to write JavaScript on my phone. I was like, wow, this is like such a powerful idea. Like I need to pursue this further. Now, the problem is like I hit some walls when it came to like adding some other language. Because like the browser runs JavaScript. Okay, so, you know, say I want to add Python, the language I was like playing around with at the time. I was like, yeah, I need to run it somewhere. I would either need to get servers somewhere. EC2 has barely been a thing at the time. And so the cloud is not really this big thing that you can go like get a server somewhere and start running code. And besides, like sandboxing, like, you know, Docker, all the sandboxing technology that we have today was non-existent at the time. And so, okay, what is the next alternative is to build like a Python interpreter in JavaScript. And I was like, okay, this seems really hard. I'm going to go and try building other languages that are easier. So I built Lisp and Scheme Interpreter. And I put those under a dropdown. And at the time, the website was called jsrepl.com. So if you go to today, it goes to REPL. But I gave it to my friends and they used it more and they loved it. And we were all like learning Scheme, which is like this Lisp variant. And everyone was using it. And it was like such an amazing feeling, just like as a builder to like make something and for people to use. So that was like this sort of the germ of the idea. But I mean, it took many years to get it to something usable. In 2011, I released what is like now kind of resembling REPLit, but I had used mscripten, which is the predecessor to WASM, to compile Python and a bunch of other languages to JavaScript to run it in the same website. And I open sourced all of that. So I open sourced, there's a project in GitHub, JS REPL. I think we just archived it, but still there somewhere. We open sourced that and it created a bit of a movement because now for the first time you can run languages other than JavaScript in the browser. So you can easily, like we had like 5 lines of code. You can load a Python interpreter in the browser. And at a time, 2011, that was like mind blowing for people, right? Now with WASM, it's like kind of like, you know, people just take it for granted. We open sourced it. We got on Hacker News. And then Code Academy, which was a Y Combinator startup at the time, started using my open source project. So that was one. I open sourced the console that we've written. I open sourced a bunch of the code behind the website. And that got me a job at Code Academy. But literally every site that was teaching code that was using REPLit, Udacity at the time was using JS REPL. And so I came to the US on an O-1 visa. That was in like 2012. But yeah, I didn't start the actual company until 2016. And so in between, I worked on more open source stuff. At Facebook, I worked on React and React Native and happy to talk about those as well.
The journey is super intriguing, right? You have JS REPL. I see it definitely is archived, but there's 2016 where you started a company. And maybe we should start there because the company looks like an education site. It has everybody here to learn languages and you're highlighting students of how they got jobs. It definitely is very different than what the REPL is today. So maybe you start from 2016, you start a company, you have the sandbox, you know it's the future, right? You went to work at Code Academy, you know, and 2016 you started a company. What was your first thought? Why do you take this approach to build this product and all the way to like REPLit 1.0, 2018, and started Hacker News blog post? Talk about that journey. Like, what was that?
I think that was about? a misnomer that it was a 1.0. I would say we're now maybe approaching 1.0. But when we started in 2016, or when we considered going back to doing the project, there was a lot of online IDEs. So that the idea I had in 2008 and being able to be one of the first people to execute on it became less of a novel idea. By 2015, 2016, there were browser versions of literally every piece of software you can think of. Like, you know, Figma didn't come out until maybe 2018, but there was, you know, some people working on vector graphics. And so it was just in the air, the idea that like all of software is going to move to the browser and to the cloud. So that stopped being a huge differentiator. But when I looked at the online IDEs at the time, like for example, Cloud9 and Nitros, a few others, Cloud9 ended up getting bought by AWS and they're still running it. One thing I found is that they don't feel web native. I think Marshall McLuhan, which is this, you know, famous media theorist, his famous saying is like the medium is the message, but just the idea that like the medium has a certain flavor to it. And to build natively for a medium, you need to actually take that into consideration. I didn't feel like they did that at the time. It's almost like when I wasn't alive, but I read that when the TV first came out, the first TV shows were like people reading stories on air, just like sitting in front of the TV, because that's what they did with the radio. And the TV for them was like a radio with the picture, basically. And honestly, it took 100 years to get like truly TV native media that we have today with the Netflix shows and HBO and all of that. And so typically like a medium emerges before the capabilities and the culture fully catches up to that. What we didn't like about the browser IDEs in that era was, first of all, they weren't URL accessible, right? That's very important if you want to build like a web native software, is that everything has a URL. It's the universal resource location, right? They weren't collaborative by default. Some of them had some functionality that was bolted on to make it more collaborative, but it didn't have that feeling of collaboration. It wasn't sort of remixable by default. Again, like web native media is all about being able to, you know, change it, remix it, republish it. And so all these ideas were things we're interested in. I don't think we articulated them as good as we do now, but my co-founder and my wife, Haya, started talking to users. So we had this like sandbox up that was like based on this open source project, but we didn't do anything with it for like 5 years, but it still had users. So Haya started talking to them. And she came to me and she's like, look, they want all these things. It seems like this thing is really interesting. And the people that are getting the most value out of it are students and teachers. That was a little surprising to me. It wasn't entirely surprising because I built it when I was a student, but I didn't envision like the use case to be primarily educational, but it kind of makes sense. And so initially we started building for the users that we had. We wanted to get to market and start making money. And we did. We made money like almost immediately running this company. So that was the spark. But like the operating principle we had since then is like, how do you lower the barriers to entry? How do you remove all the complexity from the act of making something? And that's been the thing that's been driving us since then. And so it's not only the development environment, but also hosting something is really hard. But also sharing something is not that easy. So we're taking the same mindset to every sort of bottleneck you might have to making something. And so that's really what drives us still till today.
So it seems like in 2018, that's really where, from like a funding perspective, maybe also traction perspective, things really started to take off. Can you talk us through some of the early moments of realizing that like, okay, wait, there's really something here and we're getting wide adoption or we're getting the right kind of users? Like, what were some of the earliest memories you have of like, okay, things are really clicking?
I mean, yeah, there's so many of those. You know, I don't think there is like a singular moment, like a eureka type of moment. Maybe some other founders have those. But honestly, like it took a lot of faith to keep going because even when people were having good experience, they wanted more. And that's like a good sign, right? So it's like your customers are never satisfied. It's actually a very good sign. It might not be a great sign that you've reached some kind of product market fit, but it's a great sign that you are addressing some need in the market that is important. And I would say till this day, we don't feel like the product's complete. Honestly, like I think by June this year, I feel like we're going to reach a level of completeness that I'm going to be semi-satisfied with. But I mean, some early moments that are interesting. The first dollar is always great. I mean, when we were selling to education, we've fully exited that market now because we didn't think we could build like a, you know, venture scale business there. It was good to kind of bootstrap and early on just have that discipline of building a business. But yeah, we closed deals with like universities all over the US and Canada and Middle East and everywhere. And we closed sometimes like large deals, like $50,000 and $100,000 deals. And I loved trying my hand at like doing sales and all. I'm getting back into it now. We have some B2B component that's happening, but that was really fun. And then discovering that we had a super passionate community was fascinating. So we had this like support forum where people could go and like complain about things that are broken or missing. And one day I went there and someone posted something saying like, hey, I built a chat app, feel free to join. And then they put in a Replit link. I was like, huh, that was like, I should delete that post. It's not like a support post. But I clicked on it and this 12-year-old kid built an entire chat app that like functioned in a distributed way on top of Repl.it. And so you go in, you run the Repl.it, it connects to some other server, and you have all these people chatting, and they're mostly teenagers, and they're talking about programming, they're talking about what they're building, they're helping each other. That was really fascinating. Actually, I was watching a show like years later. It's called Halt and Catch Fire. Do you know that show? You got to watch it. It's like the best hacker, like computer history show in the world. So there was one episode where they were like building a game. It's like, you know, in the 80s or 90s. And they discover like an emergent behavior in the game where people like were hacking it to like, you know, simulate a chat room. And I was like, wow, that like literally happened with our company. And so then we started taking the community aspect a lot more seriously and figuring out that not only we have this passionate community of learners, but also builders, and they want to make things and they want to publish things and they want to be able to connect with other builders. And so that's another super important moment. I think seeing people make money. So, you know, the moments are we making money, the community is emerging, but also people making money with their product is a very satisfying feeling. Now we have people making thousands of dollars a week on Repl.it, either running their own businesses or on bounties. We created this like small marketplace. And so people are making money on tips as well. You can like tip people on Repl.it. So I would say that's another milestone. In general, I think economic milestones are important because that's like when you feel that, and I don't mean financing, I mean like actual commerce happening. That's when you feel like you have a platform that is really meaningful.
There's so many fascinating things that happens just browsing through all your content from back in 16 all the way up to like, you know, there's actually a lot of nuance detail. Like I can see you're highlighting a lot of things you mentioned, but the feeling I got reading those, I think the first impression, I feel like you're living in the future somewhere. Like you're believing in browsers as ID, which predated everybody's already common belief, right? And then I think 18, the 1.0 release, also you start to switch from a REPL into a full ID, right? There's actually idea of a full ID. And that is, I think at some level, not truly like Cloud9zero talks about ID as well. But like you mentioned, there are some nuances of how you express that and how you let people able to experience it. And so I'm very curious, like you talk about this sort of like the web native and how you want to make people feel. What are the sort of choices when it comes to like, what should we build next in Repl.it? Like to be able to say like, hey, this is what we really want to put forward as a team. Because it's a small team, right? It's really trying to enable a lot of different languages, a lot of different possibilities. Everyone builds everything, right? Everybody wants to build it, this kind of app, that kind of app. And so what's kind of like a guiding principle for you to decide, okay, this is what we should do next to highlight. And when you think about like what people should be knowing Repl.it for, I feel like there's actually a very concrete choice of words and ideas you're putting out there as a theme in every sort of 1 or 2 years. Is that something you sort of rethink about as a company? Like, okay, now we don't want people to talk about as REPLs anymore. We want IDs and we want multiple REPLs that would work together. We want able to deploy a port, right? You start to really highlight sort of the fullness of the platform. That was a shift I seen in the content wise. How does that work for you as a team to decide what things we should do, which what things we shouldn't do, and some of the key lessons there?
The idea about living in the future is an interesting one. One, I think, gift that I have is being able to either spot trends or being in the trend myself, right? Like when I was talking about using my phone to code, and in the early 2000s, I was using my phone for everything. And I knew for a fact that like mobile is going to be a huge computing platform and that it's going to be a huge industry. And then like the prediction that like we're just going to use software in the browser, right? And like and just building for that. Another big prediction I made in like 2015, 2016, I wrote about it as like AI for coding. And you know, that's in full swing now and we're building for it. The other big thing I'm interested in is like, I mean, for lack of better words, people making money online. That's like materializing in the creator economy. There's like some crypto things that are interesting there. But I think the idea of like people actually being able to make a living on the internet is a very important point of maturity in the internet. And I just wanted to participate in all these trends and Repl.it in a way as a sort of a vehicle for that. And not to like ride some trends or whatever, but I have a very concrete vision of where the future of technology is headed. And I'm obsessive about it. And I want to be able to make it come sooner, want to be able to build for it, and want to be able to think about it day in and day out. And so partly that's what drives our roadmap. But a lot of it's also just like immediate user value, because you can be a visionary and you can be stuck in your head, and you can like actually not. Crypto is a good example again of this, is so much imaginary use cases that don't materialize, right? And I think for any technology, it's important that there's an immediate value. I mean, think about AI now. Like there was like an immediate value, like Copilot being like a big one, and Jasper content creation. In mobile, obviously connecting people was an immediate value, social networking, all these trends, the web. And so you want to be customer focused in addition. So that really grounds you. So you're not really building hypothetical things that no one would use. So there's this vision component to it. But then there's also like, yeah, evolving the platform. I'm a big fan of Clay Christensen's book, The Innovator's Dilemma. At this point, everyone in Silicon Valley have read it. And in a way, it's almost outdated. And I'll tell you why in a second. But it is still a very interesting theoretical concept. The idea behind it is that new technologies start out as toys, and they serve part of the market that is traditionally underserved. But over time, they develop more power, and they climb what's called the power curve until they actually compete with the incumbent. So think about x86 microcomputer. The microcomputer was, you know, kids' toys. And it was something that like just kids used, and maybe later on families. Remember Macs and early PCs. The real professionals used mainframes. But now you go to a server farm and it's all x86. Everything's x86. It just ate the entire landscape. And that story repeats in technology over and over again. And, you know, I was like, that's an interesting way to build technologies. It's like you build something, you put it out there. Maybe initially people who are not that economically valuable, sort of the kids, young people, the hobbyists, the misfits kind of start using it. But over time, these people become economically valuable. And also they grow with the product, and also the product grows and continues to acquire more and more people. So that's kind of a mindset we took to building the startup. The reason I say it's a little outdated now is because the incumbents have actually read these books and are able to. So it's not like a strategic silver bullet. Maybe it used to be. I mean, Steve Jobs famously was like handed this book to everyone at Apple, and Apple like developed this capacity to cannibalize itself, as they say, right? Because like, for example, like the iPhone ate iPod sales, and even the iPhone ate some of the Mac sales. And so you have to disrupt yourself, or otherwise someone else will disrupt you. But anyways, I think it's still a good theoretical framework for developing and growing products to become more powerful over time.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The just like coverage and capabilities that Replit's been able to build over time. One thing I'd love to chat through is who Replit is for, because so many like technologies today, it's kind of like conventional wisdom. You go after kind of like a narrow subset, you broaden over time, but the Replit user base just seems to be massive. Like you have everyone from a 12-year-old kid who probably has very little coding experience using and building with Replit. You have much more advanced engineers. Like, how did you think about just serving such a wide population?
You know, this is more like a software engineering concept, but we like to build in primitives and layers. And I think if you do that correctly, I think you will build a product that's more generalizable than you think. It's very easy to build for vertical use cases. It's a lot harder to build something horizontal. And there's a lot of companies that just fail under the weight of the long tail of use cases, right? But those who succeed do succeed big. I mean, Notion was kind of a crazy idea. Like they just want to compete with Jira, Docs, and Asana, and like databases. It's like it really bundles in a lot of different types of software. And they were able to do it because they had a basic primitive that's called like a block, right? And overall, they added more primitives to that, and they were able to link these things together. So I think you can achieve a lot more than you think. And then like Silicon Valley traditional wisdom is like, take as much technical debt as you can to reach product market fit, but you just end up with like crappy software that doesn't generalize. So we try to build in building blocks. You know, for example, the reason we support so many languages is because actually like Replit's code base doesn't have a concept of a language anymore. Replit is built on this open source technology that I'm sure you know called Nix. And we actually took a huge contrarian bet on Nix because at the time when we started adopting it, nobody was using it. Now it's become a lot more popular, but Nix is a fully functional operating system. Basically, it has this language that allows you to create an operating system from a single functional expression. So that's like a little theoretical, but what it means is that you can, instead of like, you know, getting a base Linux image and doing apt-get install and all that, you can describe an operating system in a sort of this declarative fashion and generate an environment. And then you can cache that environment because it is pure, meaning every time you run that function, it produces the same result. So it's cacheable. And you can do a lot of interesting things like content addressable caching and all of that. So languages on Replit are basically Nix expressions. So we have this 10 terabyte cache, and every REPL is created when it's run, it's running a Nix expression that generates the underlying configuration for that language. So anyone can go create languages. We maintain the top languages, but people create all sorts of templates for their companies, their products, their languages. And so we're able to support a lot of the use cases because we made languages a user space concept that people can build on top of.
Yeah, it's really interesting that I think there's a mental model of how you actually want to build the foundation of your product and sort of like building the piece layer of your later features. Because, you know, looking at the journey, even ahead, went from the REPL, right, full ports, collaboration, multiplayer, and then goes into databases, right, into statefulness, ways that could actually build more fuller applications. And now you actually have ghostwriters, right? You have AI fully powered. And I will think that there is definitely part of it is betting on the future. But as you mentioned, there's a lot of listening to your users. Your user base are massive. There's all kinds of users, right? If you listen to every single one of them, they will tell you all kinds of stuff, right? And especially now you have larger companies using you and still a lot of earlier programming folks joining in there. And it would become much, much harder to sometimes, I imagine, balance, to focus, to prioritize, like what kind of company should we really become? I don't know if that's a problem or not. It sounds like you actually have a really grounded idea of what you want. How do you update your mental model? What's is the next thing? And how do you bet on the next big thing?
We go through periods. Like we do have like a persona that we focus on. For example, like for a while, that persona was like the teenage hacker. That person needs like all teenage hackers, which I think now majority of them are starting on Replit. And the product was a good fit for them. But then, you know, what happened, Tim, was that those teenage hackers became developers and then they left Replit because Replit was not good enough for developers. So that was sad. So we needed to fix that. So now the persona was like the professional developer. So again, you go up the power curve. Now you want to maintain the lower end. So, if you think about it from a military perspective, is that you take a territory and then you want to go take another territory, but you want to defend that old territory, because if you don't, then, you know, someone else will take it. And that's actually fairly hard, right? Because, you can be spread thin. Sometimes you exit entire territories. We, exited the classroom product. A lot of teachers still use Replit, but we had this classroom product we were selling and we stopped. Instead, we merged it into teams. We're like, we're going to build teams for all sorts of companies and we're going to give it away for educators, but we're not going to build a classroom management product. You can use it with Google Classroom. You can use it with all sorts of LMS products out there, but we're just not going to build that. And it was painful. A lot of users really were disappointed. But we made a decision to just cut those features. And I think it was for the best. And it really didn't hurt our growth all that much. Although I'm sure some teachers decide to use some other thing. But what we found is that the hacker kids will still find their way to Replit because it's just the best place to be. So you want to make some tough decisions, I think. But some things should absolutely like never break. You know, what I tell my team is that the entry to programming experience should always be simple. Like, we should never overcomplicate that to the point that the product becomes unlearnable, right?
Yeah. And I wanted to make sure, since it's the open source startup podcast, so parts of Replit are open source, but the core of Replit, I don't believe is open source, or maybe it is. And maybe talk to us about what your thought process around open source, like benefits and risks, and like what you decided to go that route on versus not. So I think that's something that a lot of founders struggle with, especially early on.
Well, I think my view, and I think some people might disagree, is that there isn't a lot of value for open sourcing the application layer itself. If you're building a database, of course, it might make sense to open source it because you want to gain as much wide usage as possible. And people can just like run that on their own or inside their companies or self-host it. And there's like, you want to create an ecosystem around it. But I think in our case, like, we're building on open technologies, including our open source technologies. So we're building on Nix, we're contributing back to Nix. We're building in CodeMirror, we're contributing back to CodeMirror. We're open sourcing all the packages we build for CodeMirror. We open source a bunch of the interpreter stuff that we did around Prybar. We open source a package manager that we built called Universal Package Manager. So you can almost reconstruct Replit entirely based on the open source technologies that we either open source or contribute to. But ultimately, like, the glue layer itself is like, I'm not sure there's benefit to open sourcing. And the way to think about open source, like, from a pure, like, put aside, I think the moral and social aspect of it, which I think a lot of people care about, and I do care about as well, and freedom aspect of it. I think those are all important things that we can talk about. But purely from a capitalist point of view, you should like look at the cost-benefit analysis. There is a cost to maintaining open source. If you put something on GitHub, you have to look at pull requests. What's the point otherwise, right? And that's overhead that you need to manage. If you don't want to take contributions, don't open source, right? For our app, we're not going to take contributions. We're very particular about how we want to build it. And so we're not going to open source that. And then think about what you want to accomplish from open source. Again, if you're building something that benefits from this shared aspect of being able to build it with other people and for other people to be able to work it and change it and potentially contribute back and build extensions for it and build other businesses around it. If you want to start a movement, if you want to build it in public, if it just like inherently makes sense to be open source, some things like libraries, people try to build like closed source libraries. That's like, that's not a thing that works anymore. And that's how I think about it. I think one thing that sort of makes sense to open source that we haven't made the decision yet is the IDE itself. But right now, it's so intrinsically sort of connected to everything that we do from all the way from the back end that it just, it's unclear how we rip that out, but we're thinking about potentially doing that.
It's amazing that you said, if you want to start a movement, open source is a good way to do it. Yes, I think even though Replit, the first product or the Replit product project was open source, I think most of the Replit's movements wasn't from open source only, right? It's actually the product and all the things you do around it. Lots of developers, you know, you talk to them about the products and companies they want to start. They do want to start a Replit-like company. They want every developer they want to use, especially a developer tool founder, right? You're like, I want to build something everyone wants to use, right? You know, the passion to see something through. But it's so rare to actually be able to achieve. What will be the biggest like lessons or advice you'll give other founders looking to build developer tools? Maybe Replit did it, which is getting a lot of people to use it. Because I found in practice, a lot of founders, they have an idea, but they don't know and end up going between, okay, maybe just sell to enterprise only, because that's the only way to make money. In the sort of midst of moments, you end up going into whatever can actually achieve some metrics, right, for their startup. So it's actually much, much, much harder than I think people think. How to actually build this sort of bottom-up movements, products that can get everybody excited. What was like the key lessons you learned that you think will be worth sharing for folks?
I think it's a longer path. Like, it's much easier to go enterprise and be making millions in the first year or two. Starting a movement, whether open source or otherwise, takes years to build. And then takes many years to figure out how to monetize it because it's not baked in the idea of like how to monetize it. You know, I just invested recently in LangChain, which is sort of taking the LLM space by storm. And, you know, they have no idea how they're going to monetize in the future. They have enormous mindshare. They have a really great product and they're just building and growing with the like hope that one day an opportunity, you could sort of make up all these scenarios for how they could monetize. And be curious to hear your thoughts, since you've probably thought a lot more about open source businesses than I did, but a certain type of founder is like more attracted to that. Are you okay with uncertainty? Are you okay with losing money for a long time? Are you good at fundraising? Are you patient? Can you take large amounts of pain and keep going? Because like, you know, if you want to cater to a lot of users, like a lot of people will maybe not like what you do and give you really critical feedback, and you need to be able to accept that and improve over time. And you have to be able to build in public and be able to get Hacker News haters and be okay with that. And so it's a different, I think, personality type. But if you really want to go ahead and do it, just ask yourself whether you're committed enough to it, or can you do it for 5 years with like some amount of success, but like not the kind of traditional sort of commercial success.
I think it's such a good point. And in some ways, building a movement like this can be at odds with a fundraising timeline and expectations around certain milestones. But it's amazing what you've been able to achieve with the Replit team. Thank you so much for doing this podcast with us. Tim and I have really been looking forward to it, and it did not disappoint.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun to talk to you.